Today we talk Brandon Belt versus Lucas Duda, Anthony Rendon versus Brian Dozier, Mike Trout, auction strategy, more Billy Hamilton, and plenty more on the Fantasy Baseball Today podcast on Wednesday, February 4th. Adam Azer in New York City, Scott White, now Melchior in Fort Lauderdale,
New York
Florida.
State.
Liars. What's up?
This and that. Just, you know, gearing up for this podcast.
Why don't you tell the good people what kind of videos they can see on the website, fantasynews.cbsports.com.
Well,
and the bad people, too. Tell them as well.
Well, yeah. I mean,
I was
going to make the distinction, but the good people and the bad people, we are doing outlooks, individual player outlooks for all players in each of our top 300. So it's actually probably like 400-something players. They're all done, actually. Obviously, we'll be editing them and updating them as things unfold, but they're done. Are they out there yet? Are they out there and loving every minute of it?
Every minute.
Every minute? Okay, so they're out there, according to Al. And in addition, you'll notice the team outlooks we've been writing on the site. We're almost done with those, and each of those has a video attached to it with our new host, not of this podcast.
Oh, it makes me so sad.
Yeah, Jamie Erdahl.
I'm a big
great
Jamie Erdahl fan, but I've been watching the team outlooks, and I'm like, oh, I want to be there. I want to do that.
Well,
you should just we have a few more to film, so you can just actually know. I'm sorry, we're actually done with that, but in next videos we do, you should just crash. Just,
you know,
crash your park.
Honestly, other than those player outlook videos, as long as you're reading our content, you're going to catch every video probably, because they're all going to have one right there at the top, auto-playing. You'll probably get annoyed with them after a while because you'll have to go up and pause them. You can't miss seeing us, though, is the point.
Okay, let's dive into the news and notes, and then we'll get to the emails. This is a mailbag show. Email us at fantasybaseball@cbsi.com. fantasybaseball@cbsi.com. You have to put baseball podcast in the subject line, and the less keeper questions, the better. So the injuries and the news and the notes. Danny Salazar, according to the Cleveland Plain Dealer, being investigated by police for a possible sexual assault. Don't know much more than that now, so let's just come back to that later in the offseason with Salazar. But the only thing I'll ask you is he guaranteed a spot in the Cleveland rotation?
No, he isn't. So, you know, he's part of a group that's trying to nail down that fifth spot.
Okay. Josh Hamilton, already hurt. Spring training hasn't even started, and Josh Hamilton is hurt. He's going to have surgery to repair the AC joint in his right shoulder. He'll be out 6 to 8 weeks. This is a guy who's turning 34 in May and batted .263 with 10 homers in 89 games last year after a really good start, but a very brief, really good start. What do you guys think about the Angels outfield?
Well, for Hamilton, that might stick a fork in him as far as his mixed league values goes. Before this, I know Al was saying he had him as a $1 player in mixed leagues. I had him as a $2 player. And if you're talking about 6 weeks and who knows what kind of what kind of setbacks could come along, how if he'll be 100% after that period, nobody can say. So I might not even bother with him except in AL-only leagues. Cole Calhoun and I mean, Trout. Not much to say about Trout. You wanted to know who replaces him.
Yeah, like who stands the benefit here. That's okay.
It's still February. Yeah, getting used to this.
Yeah, remember in the last
first podcast ever.
They were throwing JB Shook in there, and you know there was not a lot of depth. Well, Shook's not even there anymore, so it's gotten worse. I think you're looking at probably at Colin Cowgill. It's not anybody that you're looking to rearrange your draft rankings for.
Could CJ Krohn benefit from this, maybe in like a DH sense? Could he get more at bats?
You know,
yeah, Matt Joyce, that's true. You could shift to outfield, so that's a good point.
Look, Adam, you didn't even have to ask us. You just wasted time.
Well, it was in the player update, so I kind of stole that from the website.
Yeah. No, Joyce was the one, the sign that they got Joyce, and that bumped Krohn to the bench, so Joyce can play outfield. I would think that would probably be the way they do things there, and at least to start the year, Krohn with his power potential is somebody who's going to be relevant, maybe just in rotisserie leagues, but relevant.
To the fun, the emails and tweets. I like mailbag shows, fellas. How do you feel about them?
I think they're delicious.
I don't generally eat them, but they're good.
Yeah, I sense sarcasm from Scott.
No, they're they're a mighty fine way to pass the time from both the analyst and the listener perspective.
Good. So we'll pass some time. Here's a tweet from Darren. How do you identify potential breakout pitchers other than reading other breakout columns and stealing them from other publications? I added that.
Besides that?
Yeah, besides that.
Okay.
You know, I used to have such a good answer to this, but things have changed so much. I mean, the very short version of what my answer used to be was pay extra close attention to strikeout rate and whip. But now it's so hard for a pitcher to stand out in those two areas. I still think there is a way for a pitcher to stand out, and it's in kind of a hidden way like that, but it's more about hidden within, you know, a smaller segment of a larger sample within the season where it looks like he's starting to turn the corner. And the most obvious example of that from this last season,
it's Carlos Carrasco.
Well, yeah, okay, Carlos Carrasco. That wasn't the one I was thinking of.
Ah.
But that is a great example. That might be a better example because he was so great to end last year, and now.
Well, I mean, there were a lot of good examples.
Well, yeah. I'm still on pins and needles waiting for Scott's example.
But we'll just go with that one. Whatever the example. Oh, Gerrit Cole was the one I was going to make because he came back from the injury and averaged like 10 strikeouts per nine. But the thing about Cole and Carrasco is that they're not really getting by anybody. They're already ranked so high. They're already going to go early. Kevin Gausman, though, might be somebody who does slip by. He seems like he's going in the late rounds, and his last couple months or so, he got to a strikeout per inning when he obviously had the stuff to do that. He just wasn't doing it until then. So he's somebody I'm high on going into this year.
And Gausman is actually at the very top of my pitcher breakout list. But in terms of how to spot them, I mean, there's a lot of different ways, but I think the main way is actually similar to the way I would identify a breakout hitter, which is that you look at the skill set and you look for players who have shown a broad range of skills at a high level, but not all at the same time. So somebody who maybe, came on the scene and had a really good year in terms of strikeouts, but then regressed in the second year, but became better at getting ground balls, that kind of thing. So somebody who has not put it all together yet. So Gausman would be a good example of that, I think, going into this year.
Al, give me one more guy, one more breakout pitcher, if Gosman's the headliner. Who's the warm-up act?
What's that?
Who's the warm-up act?
Just the warm-up act. Okay. Well, this is I'm just going to go ahead and fly with this because the next guy I'm thinking of is actually somebody who is atypical because a breakout pitcher is usually somebody in his early to mid-20s. I think Jay Happ is going to have a breakout this year.
Whoa.
He's in his 30s, his early 30s. But he fits that description of somebody who, in recent years has pitched with a lot better control. And I think that he's not going to be a great strikeout guy, but I think there's upside there in terms of that, even for a soft tosser. And going to Seattle, I think, is going to help him a lot. Change of venue can also be a factor you look at. So, sure, cool. Why not?
Okay, it's pretty gutsy. I like it. Next tweet from Collins Allison. Gerrit Cole or Jacob deGrom, Brandon Belt or Lucas Duda in an OBP league? So we'll start with the pitchers. Cole or deGrom?
DeGrom, and it's pretty close. It's just Cole, I think, is still working his way up to what DeGrom already accomplished last year. So unless you're just totally skeptical of the skill set for DeGrom, and I mean, if you watched him pitch, you probably wouldn't be. Then you should go DeGrom.
I'll go DeGrom, and I'll just make it a Mets sweep here and go Duda over Belt.
Yeah.
Because I certainly trust the power more for Duda, and I'm not sure I trust the OBP for Belt, even though he clearly has the potential. But he, too, is a breakout candidate who could put it all together.
I mean, it's not like Duda's a bad OBP guy.
No, it's not like that.
No. Now, Brandon Belt, just to talk about him, you talk about a potential breakout here. Look what he did before his concussion last year in 35 games. He hit 264 with 9 home runs. That's pretty good. 9 home runs in 35 games. He's going to be 27 years old in April. The overall numbers don't look great, but he was a lot better before he missed all the time with the concussion. What do you guys see from Belt, who had a 360 OBP 2 years in a row before last year, in 2012 and 2013?
Year.
Yeah, last year really struggled.
Well, that's the thing. We haven't really hammered down who Belt is, because he went from being this, you know, kind of a so-so power guy. Well, I guess maybe on the lower end in terms of power for a first baseman, but he got on base. Look, he would hit for a high average. And then last year, he completely flipped the script. And so it's hard for me to put much stock in the power breakthrough, A, because it was an injury-shortened season, and B, because it came at the expense of everything else he did right. He's just... he's a guy I've been pushing as a breakout for several years now, and this year I don't see it for him.
Scott,
it could happen, but I don't see it.
Yeah, breakout fatigue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Al.
Yeah, I've gotten projected for 23 home runs, so I do buy into the power somewhat, but again, at first base, that's not, you know, going to wow you. And, you know, a 260-ish batting average. So I think he's capable of much better, but we've seen the polar extremes from Belt, so I'm kind of split in the middle there. And saying he's going to, you know, be just sort of mediocre in terms of batting average, I guess, and power.
Here's a tweet from Jake. Who's the next Cuban sensation to get this year?
Like somebody who hasn't signed yet?
And or like a Yasmani Tomas or something, like a new guy who hasn't been drafted in fantasy yet.
Oh, well.
Then I guess, you know, Moncada would be the next one on the horizon, but you know, we still have to see where he's going to sign and you know what kind of timetable he's going to be on.
Yeah, and he's only 19, so I would guess he's not contributing this year. But I don't know. Is Tomas an appropriate answer? Is Rusne Castillo an appropriate answer? They're both going in the middle rounds. If you've done any mock drafting at this point, and maybe I'm being presumptuous here, and most people haven't, but they're both guys who are going to go in the middle rounds. Castillo actually is one of my favorite middle round outfielders to target. He's a guy who's gotten some comparisons to Andrew McCutchen, probably going overboard there, but a 2020 season I don't think is out of his reach. And then Yasmani Tomas, who just signed with the Diamondbacks this offseason, 25 homer guy, low OBP probably, so a few rounds later than Castillo.
Yeah, I agree with all that, and I think I really took this question way too literally, thinking next, sort of leapfrogging over those two guys.
But
they're the ones definitely that you could safely target right now.
I want to bring something up about Castillo and ask you a question about hitters and even pitchers who do really well in September. And Castillo only played 10 games last year. We didn't really know much about him before that. He played very well. He had 333 with two home runs and three steals. His home runs came off Tampa Bay reliever Steven Geltz and Yankees reliever Sean Kelly, who is no longer a Yankees reliever. I don't know where Steven Geltz is, I admit. But my question is, we know the competition in September is a lot worse than it would be in any other month because of all the call-ups. And a lot of these guys are playing worthless baseball and meaningless games against teams who are also out of it. So, like, does that change your evaluation at all of a guy who does well for 10 games at the end of September?
Well, I mean, look, I don't want to put much stock in those 10 games for Castillo is a very particular case because, you know, you only had the scouting reports to go on before he played those 10 games. He had taken a year off of baseball, had about 10 games of minor league action, postseason minor league action to warm up, and then he got those 10 games in the majors. So really, given how much the Red Sox invested in him and the hype attached to him, really all I needed to see from him was that he didn't fall flat on his face, that he didn't look overmatched, that he wasn't just hitting ground balls and pop-ups. I just wanted to see some level of competence there, and I was going to be optimistic about him with all the other factors to consider. But just speaking more generally, like somebody like Xander Bogaerts, he had a big September relative to the rest of the season. I don't know.
Yeah, go ahead.
Did you want me to answer that generally, or is it just about Castillo?
Generally.
Generally?
Yeah.
I get the theory. I think it would take some really extensive research to for all the players who had notable Septembers to look at all the pitchers they did their damage against, because it's not like the good pitchers stop pitching in September unless there's, you know, a handful do because of innings limits. Mm-hmm. But they're still out there pitching too. So if it's really cherry picked where these breakout September players are doing their damage, I could see it. But to just theorize that that's the reason, I don't think it adds up, because I don't think there's enough weaker pitchers out there for them to do all their damage against them.
Sure.
And you know, I just don't worry about it, because whether it's September or May, we all have to remember that Unieski Betancourt was really, really good for a month once upon a time. So it doesn't even really matter what month it is or what the competition is, because it's just crazy things can happen over a month.
Yeah, I mean, Juan Francisco has 1 month every season, right? Where he's awesome.
Yeah.
All right, then let's move on and get a question here from David in New York City. He says, "Dear Shane, Andrea, and Herschel." Scott, you know that, right?
Yes. The Walking Dead. Did you look it up already or something?
I did, yes.
Yeah.
I didn't even have to, because you were all over it. Here's a quick guess the player for you. Both players play the same position. Player A is 24. He hit 21 home runs, scored 111 runs, 83 RBI, 17 steals, and a 351 OBP.
A lot of RBI, gee. Oh, no, runs scored.
Yeah, a lot of runs.
Yeah.
Player B is 27. He hit 23 home runs with 112 runs scored, 71 RBI, 21 steals, and a 345 OBP. Basically the same stats, fewer RBI, four more steals. Player A is being drafted number 12 overall, player B number 70. Player A is Anthony Rendon, and player B is Brian Dozier. Is it a bit early to be lavishing a first-round pick on Rendon with just one full season under his belt? And doesn't Dozier deserve a little more love?
Yes, on both counts.
I am
making it a mission. In fact, I wrote it today in a Nationals Outlook that should be up any second now if it's not up already on the site. You know, just kind of pounding my fist that, you know, Rendon, yes, he's one of my top two second basemen, but I think that he is not a first rounder and he's not number one. That should be, and I'm sorry, second base. Third base should be Josh Donaldson number one at third base, should be Altuve number one at second. Okay. Rendon was good. He had something of a breakout last year, but let's not get carried away. And
Come on, look at where he finished. He performed where he's being drafted. I don't think anybody's getting carried away. It's not
sure
like Bryce Harper getting drafted in the second round.
Why do you assume he's going to hit 20 home runs again next year?
Well, even if he hits 18, big deal. He's still an elite second baseman.
Why so much better than Dozier then?
Because he's just a better player than Dozier. One thing he leaves out of this comparison is batting average, which, okay, it matters in rotisserie leagues.
It really does, Scott.
And the other thing he leaves out is that Brian Dozier's season was super front loaded. It's not like he was a disaster after that home run binge early on, but he clearly wasn't Rendon level. So it's just not a fair comparison.
Yeah, you bring up the batting average, which is a good point. If you're not playing OBP league and you're playing in categories, the batting average really does sink Dozier's his roto rank anyway. Last 2 years, Dozier, I just want to look it up here, he was the number 5 second baseman in points and number 11 in Roto in 2013, and he was number 3 in points and number 5 in Roto last year. So that does make a difference. Al, I'm sorry, do you want to say anything else about the subject?
No. I agree with all that, but I also agree with David. I mean, I don't know if he was trying to make the point that they're the same player. I don't think he was. He was saying that the gap in perception shouldn't be what it is. I agree with the point.
Is there a gap in perception,
that Rendon
though?
Should not be a first rounder.
Basically,
Dozier should go a couple rounds earlier.
Basically, our two mock drafts so far, Rendon's been a second round pick. Dozier's been a fourth round pick. So that to me doesn't seem like much of a perception gap.
Well, he's citing some draft averages that, you know, maybe we're in this office more on board with them being closer in value, but these numbers don't surprise me. That I think there probably are skeptics out there on Dozier, and I think there are people who are ready to crown Rendon as the number one at second or third and take him in the first round, and I think that's a reach.
Next email is from Matt. It's a keeper question. Matt, lucky enough to get his keeper question answered. much to my dismay. 16-team, head-to-head points league. I can keep a player forever, and I need to add $4 to their salary per year. I can only keep four of these five. So here are my options and their salaries for this year. Javier Baez at $9, Chris Bryant at $5, Corey Dickerson at $7, George Springer $9, Gregory Polanco $5. Baez $9, Bryant $5, Dickerson $7, Springer $9, Polanco $5.
Yeah, I think the odd man out there is Baez, as much as it pains me, because I think I think he'd be a fine keeper at that price, but those others are just too good to pass up.
I'm not completely sold on Polanco. It's, for me, it's more of a struggle to decide between Baez and Polanco. I'll go ahead and go with Baez. But to me, it's almost a toss-up.
Baez out or Baez in?
Baez out.
Yeah.
Mike from Atlanta. You talk about pitchers benefiting from switching to the from the AL to the NL. But being from Atlanta, last year I drafted Brian McCann because I thought he would do great in Yankee Stadium. However, he got off to a slow start. Can you talk about the effect switching leagues has on hitters and if it should affect your draft strategy?
That's a really good question, and it's hard to generalize, but it does affect some hitters. It's just a question of making a bet, you know, on a particular hitter when I think there are probably some hitters that it affects more than others.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think the AL to the NL thing or vice versa, that's something that, you know, you can feel pretty confident in just because, you know, the overall numbers bear it out. But, yeah, I think you just kind of have to take your chances that a player is going to make a smooth transition from one venue to another, particularly if or one team to another, if they're in the same league.
Mm-hmm. Well, pitchers, it's not a super clear cut thing, but pitchers I would generally expect to do a little better in the NL just because they're facing one less hitter every time through.
Yeah.
In McCann's case specifically, I think we just learned McCann's not a very good player. His final numbers were basically in line with the way the last few seasons have gone, and a lot of his downfalls had to do with the increased use of shifts, infield shifts. So I don't know how much going to the AL really had to do with it. If you're saying that he was especially bad in the beginning, okay, maybe there was some factor there, but by the end of the year, he basically had a typical McCann season.
And I think, Scott, he ended up being a top six catcher or something like that because he got a lot of at bats. And I think, you know, people that drafted him thinking he was going to be better because of Yankee Stadium, they weren't far off. If I recall, he was one of those guys where you sat him if you could when he was on the road. Yeah, like he slugged .496 at home. He hit 19 home runs at home. He hit four on the road all season. So
that's
did work.
Extreme. Yeah.
Now, the thing with catchers that switch teams is they have to learn a new pitching staff, which might make them get off to a slow start.
I'm looking at the monthly splits here, and it seemed like he got off to a slow start because, you know, you weren't expecting him to be a .230 hitter necessarily, but month by month his stats were pretty steady. He hit a lot. He hit his most home runs in September, but the batting averages and the home runs apart from September were basically the same, about the same every month.
Now, do you guys think that players who sign big contracts are likely to struggle in their first year with the new team? There are some examples. Pujols, I think we'll see what happens with Cano. But maybe that's what happened there. You definitely hear stories of guys feeling like they have to live up to the contract.
Yeah, and you know, retroactively or retrospectively, those guys will, you know, say, yeah, you know, I really put too much pressure on myself last year. But again, it's sort of like the changing teams thing. I'm sure it affects some players more than others, but we really have no way to know who. So you just wind up being pleasantly or unpleasantly surprised.
Let's go to another tweet here from Itchy Banaba. Auction league question. How much is Trout worth in a roto auction? Can you talk about the value of the guys going in the first round?
I think you can justify, and I can't remember ever really saying this before, I think you could justify close to $50 for Trout.
I don't think the gap is as big as the gap. It was a two-player gap last year, Trout and Cabrera.
Yeah.
I don't think the gap is as big between Trout and everyone else this year as it was between Trout and Cabrera and everyone else last year. Because Trout himself, the loss of steals, The batting average, I think, is a legitimate question now with as often as he strikes out. So he's clearly number one, but I think the biggest drop off in the first round is after the top five or six. The reason I say five or six is because that sixth guy is Kershaw. So it depends on your tolerance for drafting a pitcher in the first round, or you know, in this case, an auction, spending that much on a pitcher. Those would be the guys who I would go in a mixed league, probably a good extra $5 to get on my team. Since it's, you know, if you can get super elite talent in a shallower league, you probably should.
Up to what, though? Because, I mean, Al said $50. We're talking $260 budget here, and we're framing this as a 12-team mixed auction. You know, how much would you spend on Mike Trout?
You know, I guess I'm kind of a weirdo when it comes to auctions, because I don't really like to restrict myself to certain numbers. I kind of go with the flow of the auction, see how...
He's the first player nominated, buddy.
He's the first player nominated.
You got $260 to spend. Mike Trout.
Well, I would probably stop bidding around 50 as well.
Okay.
Yeah, I have valued, and I have the complete opposite orientation to Scott that... I go pretty closely by my numbers because I want to be able to budget and you know, have an expectation of where to draw the line.
Well, I like having an expectation. I like having knowing, you know, I come up with auction values. If I didn't come up with my own, I'd look at somebody else's because I would know then that the distribution between the 276 players who are going to be auctioned comes out to, you know, everybody spending all their money. So if I noticed in the auction that high-end players were all going over or were all going under a certain amount, that there would be more or less money on the table later in the auction. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wouldn't want to be too rigid with it. I'd want to be able to adapt to what's happening in the auction. If they're all going for too little, well, I should probably get more of them than I had planned initially, because that means the mid-range players are going to go for too much just because of all the money on the table. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense.
Okay.
How about AL-only and NL-only leagues? How does that change with auctions?
At the top end, I think not too much. It's more with the middle guys. And, of course, the middle guys in those single leagues are, you know, more like the replacement level, you know, low-value guys in the mixed leagues. So somebody who might be a $2 or $3 player in mixed, oftentimes, you know, I'm willing to go about 10. Mm-hmm. Or maybe even a little more, depending on the position, in AL or NL.
And last question here, back to the mixed league. If Trout is worth $50, how much is, let's say, Paul Goldschmidt worth?
For me, Goldschmidt, Cabrera, McCutchen, I'm going to top out around 40 for those guys. And as you get towards the end of the first round, where I would project guys like Tulowitzki, Rizzo, then I'm probably looking at lower 30s.
I would go higher. I'd go 45 for those other guys in my top five or six. And for the record, what I actually project them for, Trout at 41, McCutchen and Goldschmidt, or at least McCutchen's at 38. I think Goldschmidt might be 37. So definitely lower. I'm kind of projecting for a more sane group of auction group of bidders there than I am. I tend to be pretty reckless. I guess reckless isn't the right word. I tend to be pretty aggressive when it comes to the super high end guys in an auction.
Reckless. I think that's a Bryan Adams album, right, Al?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. That's scary to me that we made the same word association.
You were going there too?
Yeah.
Wow, must be me.
Yeah, I bring the Bryan Adams iPod
out of everyone. All right, next tweet is from @DunDunDun. Which lineup has improved the most, and which lineup has improved the least?
The most ones come to mind more readily.
I had an idea for who improved the least.
All right. Well, the most, the ones that come to mind are Padres and Marlins, and I'm probably forgetting somebody obvious. But they've really loaded up.
Yeah, they have. I think the Blue Jays have improved. Not that they weren't good to begin with. The White Sox, more their pitching staff has improved, but their lineup has too.
Indians got Brandon Moss. I like it.
They've had a quiet offseason. That's pretty much all they've done.
Mm-hmm.
Who's improved the least? I'll tell you, the Yankees have added pretty much nobody.
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by improved the least, because there are certainly teams that have
gotten worse.
That's okay. They're standing pat like the Yankees did,
okay,
and
well,
they're doing
one
what the Braves did.
Yeah, the Braves.
Unloading three of their four best hitters.
And the Rays.
The
Braves and the Rays.
Yeah.
Now, the Rays, does that worry you for Evan Longoria, just not getting any pitches?
Sure. And it definitely worries me for him, because in doing one of the aforementioned player outlook videos, I went back and looked at what was going on with his power decrease last year. And pitchers were throwing in kind of his cold zone, which is down and away, more often last year. So I don't see any reason for that to change.
Interesting. Ready for the next email?
Indeed.
Yes.
You ready for the Billy Hamilton debate again?
I'm totally ready for this, because part of the reason I was a little late for this podcast, I was writing a blog post about Mr. Hamilton.
Hey, okay. Well, here's the email. It's from Jerry. He says, last podcast, Adam and Scott got into it a little bit about Billy Hamilton. A lot of good points made on both sides, but I wanted to discuss a point that I have yet to hear any fantasy podcast or magazine address. Last year, I had Hamilton, which enabled me to deploy a very unique and effective strategy, specifically for head-to-head formats. I rostered a power bat, specifically for when I had established a comfortable lead in steals each week, and would usually be able to swap him in for Hamilton for weekend games. When I added up all the stats that I received from both players when they were active in my lineup, it was the equivalent of one player hitting 19 homers and stealing 46 bases with solid counting stats. Just thought I'd share this with you guys and hopefully hear you expand on this strategy as I plan on employing it yet again this season. So that is obviously for a daily league rather than the weekly league.
Yeah, and that's probably why he hasn't heard it discussed, is because it seems like it's a very specific scenario here, the head-to-head categories league. With daily lineup changes, that's not usually a group we cater to. So I see the validity of it. It would take a certain level of discipline, and I kind of think if you're shoehorning Hamilton into this part-time role, that's not a great use of a fifth round pick still. So I don't know that it makes your point and refutes mine.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it's a little bit too specific here. Like, for example, you would hate to lose steals by one because you benched Hamilton for the weekend, you know, and like I could see that totally not working out. I could see you losing both categories in very steals and homers because you just didn't figure out the right combination of Hamilton plus your power guy. Yeah, I don't know. It was an interesting email. I don't know that it does much for either of our points, but I would like to hear what Al Block.
Yeah, he's chomping at the bit here.
Not really, because the research I was doing on Hamilton was more kind of geared towards weekly leagues. And I don't know, but just on the face of it, this does sound like a good strategy to me, because he's saying he would only make that swap in particular situations. So if there was any tightness at all in the steals standings, then Hamilton would be a full-time player for him in those weeks. So it's more like the power guy would be the specialist. I don't know. It's kind of hard to judge it without really getting into what the trade-offs are. But at face value, it sounds like a good strategy for that kind of format. But what I was researching and writing about Hamilton was really trying to break down his value, because I'm not touting him as highly as I did last year, but I still have him as a $20 player. And even though he doesn't gain you anything in any of the other four 5x5 categories, he does, even with a conservative projection, give you enough in steals to earn $20 or more. And a really, really conservative projection would still make him a $16 player.
What do you have Revere as dollar-wise? Ben Revere.
I'll have to look that up.
Because I guess Revere's pretty much assured 40 steals, right?
Yes.
And Hamilton had what last year? 50-something?
56, and I think he's pretty safe for 60.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. So
right there, just to do the shorthand, a 20-steal difference is you know, two or three worth two or three places in the stolen base standings. So that's, you know, that's kind of significant. And I'm sorry, I'm really fumbling my control F here right now. But I've got Revere as a $14 player. So he's kind of what I have for him is sort of the middle of the road projection would be like slightly worse than what I think the worst case scenario is for Hamilton.
You know, I just had, this is kind of just an anecdotal thing, but I feel like there have been times where it became apparent to me my roster wasn't going to have a lot of steals. And so I made a point to get a couple steal specialists, which is what Hamilton is. I mean, he's on the high end of steal specialists, but that's what he is. And it never goes well. It never goes well. I mean, the guy may give me steals, but it's either not enough or just the other hitting categories. I don't end up being as stout in them as I thought I was, probably in part because of the steals guy was robbing from them.
I think
it's just not my favorite approach.
Billy Hamilton is the fastest player I have ever seen in my life. And I'm not kidding.
No, it's
he tagged
right
up on a ball that barely made the outfield grass in shallow right field, and he scored. And I think with another year, learning the pickoff moves, learning the pitchers that he's facing, I do think the steals will be enough to make a difference where he's not a 56 steal guy. I think 70 or up, I mean, I would not be surprised if he stole 80 bases. I wouldn't project that, but that's a lot, but it could happen. And Ellsbury has a 70 steal season, right?
From yes.
Like, there's no reason why Billy Hamilton cannot get that. He is so much faster than Jacoby Ellsbury, and I'm not putting a 56 steal or a 60 steal limit on Billy Hamilton.
The only reason I could really give you is just if he doesn't make progress at the plate. And even if he does, even if he flatlines and hits 250, I still think, you know, I like his chances for 65 to 70, if not more. But if he took a step backwards somehow, which I don't expect, yeah, then he's not getting on base very much, and he's going to be hard pressed to get 60 steals.
Sure. All right, Andy from Iowa, Billy Hamilton. No, just kidding. He says, "Dear Holmes, Jeremy, and North." I have no idea what that is. Scott?
Nope, not me.
I even Googled it, and I found nothing.
It's not The Walking Dead.
You knew better than to ask.
Yeah. I should have muted your mic. If only I had control of that now. Daily head-to-head league where holds, saves, and strikeouts are categories. Sometimes I have no starting pitcher throwing that day. I like to put a relief pitcher with starting pitcher eligibility in that roster spot. Are there any relievers with starting pitcher eligibility this year that can help me to pile on the stats on my starters' off days?
The only pitcher I can think of is Henry Mejia.
Well, that was pretty quick thinking on your part, because that's better than I can do.
It's the only one, though, that I can think of. There may be one. If there's anybody else out there, it's probably not anybody who's going to be very impactful.
How about
there you go.
Kyle Kendrick? Is he going to be a reliever for the Rockies?
Oh, gosh. he's going to be a disaster for the Rockies. So
he made $5.5 million or something like that, right?
Oh,
insane.
Good money.
Yeah, good for him.
Good money for what he's going to give them. Not saying, you know, it's going to be his fault, just that.
Ooh. Alexi Ogando?
Did he make any starts last year? I don't think he made any.
Ah!
Did not five. I know. This is a fruitless exercise.
Okay.
That probably only helps the one guy who emailed us. So maybe
well, then, we'll move on.
Yeah,
Rich from Brooklyn. Grade the trade. Give up Paul Goldschmidt, who I can keep in the third round only for this year. And I get Jose Altuve, who I can keep this year in the fifth round and next year in the fourth round. Grade the trade.
Even with that favorable keeper situation, I'm going to give that a C-.
Yeah, I agree. You'd have to be playing for next year, I think, to do that.
Okay, then.
It's too early for that.
Yeah, I would think.
Next up, Michael from Portland. Hey, Dylan, Matt, and Jacob.
Yeah, Matt's pitcher.
All right. There's been a lot of talk about when to draft pitchers. I agree that in a roto league, you have to get an ace and then wait. Would you consider John Lester, a 12th-round keeper, and Matt Harvey, a 21st-round keeper, ace-quality pitchers? If so, how long could I wait to draft a pitcher in a 12-team, 23-round, 6x6 categories league? So do you basically consider Lester and Harvey to be aces?
Lester, yeah. And in fact, in our most recent Roto Mock, that's exactly what I did. I went out and got him as my number one pitcher. Harvey probably will.
Probably.
There could be a little bit of an innings limit.
I wouldn't feel comfortable with Harvey as my number one. I'd feel awesome about him as my number two, because I think he probably will perform like a number one.
All right, then. So you can probably wait a while to draft a pitcher if you keep Lester in the 12th.
Yeah.
And not as long if you keep Harvey in the 21st.
Okay.
Well, so, I mean, you probably should keep both if you can.
But. Yeah, I was going to say, if it's either or, then I'd say then you're maybe waiting 4 or 5 rounds. But if you're keeping both, I think you could wait till the 10th round, possibly.
Sam A. in North Hollywood, California. What are your thoughts on Manny Machado?
Yeah, I was... He hasn't gotten a lot of hype, and maybe that's maybe that makes him potentially of value, because it seemed like the little stretch where we saw him play, because right there was an injury at the beginning and at the end.
Yeah,
it looked like and this is just me going off memory. It looked like he was showing more power. It looks like the slugging percentage ended up the same, but maybe there was a situation.
I got the breakdown. Guys, I got the stat breakdown for you. You ready?
Okay. Yep.
Well, first of all, do you know what his nickname is according to Baseball Reference?
I don't.
Well, I'm looking at it, so I'm not going to give it away.
Yeah, it would be Hakuna Machado, which I think is not true, but anyway.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one.
He played 82 games last year, and remember, I don't know if did he have any spring training, maybe a little bit, but his off season was a mess. Bottom line, so this year he should have more of an off season. He suffered the knee injury earlier in the year. First 26 games, he hit 2 home runs, batted .210. Machado was terrible. Next 56 games, he hit .311 with 10 home runs and 13 doubles. His batting average was .311, on base .353, and a .505 slugging.
That's what I was getting to. I feel like he got off to a slow start and then took off right before getting injured. And actually, the last 35 of those games, he hit 8 of those home runs, so .948 OPS. I mean, a guy who's just now only 22 years old really hasn't even come close to peaking yet. There is going to be, I think, a huge breakout at some point, and if that was just a foretaste of it, then the lack of hype, I think this is probably the year to draft Machado.
Let's do all right, Machado or David Wright. You get Wright in the 7th and Machado in the 10th. Who would you rather have?
I'd still rather have Wright.
Yeah, I would too, just because it sounds kind of weird, I guess, but I feel like the floor's higher for Wright coming off a bad season, I know, but I feel like it is.
That totally summarizes why I would go that way.
Yeah.
Machado or Chris Davis?
Machado.
I've got Davis ranked a little higher. I mean, if you're going to give me like a round differential, I could see
8th round
going
for Chris Davis, 10th round for Machado.
Yeah, I'd say not enough difference. It's close. I'm going Davis there.
Then let's go to our last question of the day. Maybe we have time for more, but this could be our last one. It's Jeremy in Dallas. He's calling out Al on his rankings.
Oh, no.
And
this is
going to
take a long time.
Al, would you... ready, Al? Would you really take Matt Wieters over Yu Darvish in Roto? Help me understand this if it's not a typo.
It's not a typo, but it will be corrected. So I get increasingly nervous about Wieters. When I was working on projections, I was very excited about him as a breakout guy, even coming off the Tommy John. But I feel like the optimism was a little misplaced and overdone. So, Wieters will be downgraded. Order will be restored.
Let's do two more quickly here. Jeff Rice on Twitter. Does pitch recognition diminish at the same rate as other skills? What to expect from OBP monsters like Votto, Wright, Ortiz, and Bautista?
You know, there's research on this, and for the life of me, I don't remember, with a lot of certainty what the outcome is. So,
I would guess it doesn't, though. That's one of what makes it great is it's so consistent over a course of a player's career. I mean, just thinking, and I'm kind of just handpicking examples here, Jimmy Rollins has actually gotten better. Chase Utley hasn't really declined in that respect. Adam LaRoche last year
But I think if you go outside the NL East, it might be.
What about Wade Boggs?
Yeah, I mean, Scott gives some great examples. My recollection of it is that it does decline at a similar rate, or maybe even a faster rate than power. Like I said, I can't really speak confidently on this, so maybe we can come back to that.
I can't speak confidently.
One more email, then. Dear Henry, Blake, and Garen.
Those would be Red Sox prospects.
Oh.
Yeah, Henry Owens, Lego. Blake.
Sweetheart.
Yeah. And
Shaquini.
Yep.
Do you prefer starting pitching and relief pitcher spots, just straight pitching designation, or a combination of the two, and why?
I actually think it's kind of perfect between the way the two formats have it set up. I like that Roto League. It's typically just a pitcher designation, so you can kind of determine for yourself how hard or not you're going to go after saves. Since it's you know each category is distinct from the others, but in head to head points leagues where all the categories just run together into a point total, I think it's more sensible to have everyone having a pitching staff on the same terms, in that like a real big league club, you're going to have a starting rotation, you're going to have a bullpen, and you're not going to veer much off of that.
Yeah, I think definitely having no designation changes strategy, makes it a little bit more interesting. I don't know if I prefer either way, but if you're in a roto league and you need to catch up on strikeouts or wins or something late in the year, you can sit your closers. I think that's kind of fun. Last word, Al Melchior?
Yeah, if I'm thinking of in a head-to-head league, if they took away the designations, or in a roto league, if they forced them, yeah, I wouldn't like either of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I especially wouldn't like not being forced to carry two relief-eligible pitchers in a points league.
Yeah.
So there.
Nobody would ever start relievers if...
Yeah, probably not.
It's a good call.
Yeah, except Sparps.
Yeah.
That's a good call. And that is it for our mailbag show. I had a great time. I always do.
I hope you had the time of your life.
Nobody puts Adam in the corner.
Totally different time of our lives songs. Generation gap right there, big time. Dirty Dancing and Green Day. All right, Al Melchior and Scott White, thank you very much. I'm Adam Azer. We'll talk to you next week with some position previews here on the Fantasy Baseball Today podcast on CBSSports.com.